of Genesis chapter 34 this morning. Genesis chapter 34. And I was talking to my wife this morning. She was asking about the message this morning, and I said, I mentioned to her the story here, and she's familiar with the story, and she said, that's a weird one. This is a story of Dinah. And as we go through the book of Genesis, there's some different stories you show up. There's some you hear about in Sunday school all the time. This is not one of them. This would bring up a lot of questions in Sunday school. And it kind of makes me glad we're going through this book on Sunday mornings when the kids are out there. I don't have to answer questions about this. But you know what? It's in the Bible for a purpose. And that's what I love about just preaching straight through like this. And there's other ways of doing it. I understand. I'm not opposed to that. But I have found, just as we've gone through, there are things you'll hit as you go through that you might not have decided. You know, I probably wouldn't decide, you know what, I'm going to preach on Genesis 34, and you'll see it as we read it. That's not one that's like, that'd be a fun one to preach. No, there's some weird things in here, but it's there, and it's there for a purpose, and I think as we get the full counsel of God here, as we go through the Bible, it really covers a lot of things and shows us kind of the skeletons in some closets of God's people. You don't see it. You see this family. These are God's people. Jacob, you know, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham. Great family there, but they had their issues. And if your family has issues, then maybe you can relate a little bit. Hopefully not this bad, but you know, we say, hey, if they can make it, then we can make it. So let's read the book of Genesis, chapter 34. We're going to back up just a little bit to 33, because we want to get the setting. Just the last couple of verses. Let's look at verse 18 of Genesis chapter 33. We read this last week, but just kind of gives us the setting, because there's some names here that if we're not careful, we can get them mixed up. It says in verse 18 of Genesis 33, it says, "And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan." Okay, so there's the land of Canaan, that's the promised land, and then there's an area called Shechem. It's not exactly a state, but it's kind of a region, like we'd say the panhandle or something. That's an area called Shechem. And there's a city called Shalem. So try not to get that confused. I'll try to be careful as I say them and try not to get them mixed up myself. But Shalem's the town, okay? So Jacob comes to Shalem there. It says, "When he came from Padan Aram," that's up there in the far northeast, "and pitched his tent before the city. And he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money." Okay, now here's a different Shechem, just to keep it confusing. Shechem here is the name of a guy. Okay, we're going to see him in chapter 34. It's like, I thought that was the name of the region. It was. It'd be like someone naming their kid Panhandle. What a name. You know, but whatever. So Shechem is a guy. His father is Hamor, who's in charge of the city of Shalem in the land of Shechem. Okay, so that's where Jacob is. "And he erected there an altar and called it El Elohi Israel," which means God, the God of Israel. So he made a name. He kind of put his rock there and said, "I worship Jehovah God." That's what he did. Okay, now chapter 34. "And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor," okay, the guy, "the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. And his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem," the kid here, "spake unto his father Hamor, saying, get me this damsel to wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly in Israel in laying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. And Hamor communed with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you, give her him to wife. And ye make marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you. And ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you dwell, and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein. And Shechem said unto her father and unto her brethren, let me find grace in your eyes, and what ye shall say unto me I will give. Ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give according as ye shall say unto me. But give me this damsel to wife." Can you tell he wants this damsel to wife? He's a pretty lovesick guy. Verse 13, and the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father deceitfully, and said, because he had defiled Dinah their sister, and they said unto them, we cannot do this thing, to give our sister unto one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent unto you, if ye will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, then will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters unto us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then will we take our daughter, and we will be gone. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. And the young man deferred not to do the thing, because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came unto the gate of their city and communed with the men of their city, saying, these men are peaceable with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade therein. For the land, behold, it is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us for wives. Let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised. Look at this. Shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. And unto Hamor and unto Shechem his son hearkened all that went out of the gate of the city. Every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of his city. And it came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. And they took their sheep and their oxen and their asses and that which was in the city and that which was in the field and all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives took they captive and spoiled even all that was in the house. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, ye have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, should he deal with our sister as with an harlot? Not really a Sunday school story. Not one that you probably heard growing up, Miss Margaret. I doubt you teach this in there very often. If you do, my boys are going to be playing this out, and I don't want that to happen. So, interesting, but it's here for a reason. There's some good stuff in here, right here. It's not on the surface, but we'll dig in a little bit and see the Jacobsons. We're calling this the Jacobsons Get the Munchies. That's what I'm calling this sermon this morning. You'll see why here in just a minute. At one point during the first couple of years of our marriage, probably while we were dating, we would go on picnics sometimes for a couple of reasons. It's romantic and it's cheap. Mainly the second one, but that's what it is. And so we go on picnics sometimes, and Heather would make a lunch, and I remember the first couple of times she would bring chips on the chip. Now I enjoy chips, but growing up I wasn't really into chips that I can remember. I would eat them if they were like some kind of cool flavor, you know, sour cream and onion or barbecue chips, something like that. But she got these like plain Lay's potato chips. Now I didn't that I never had a desire or any interest in plain Lay's potato chips. To me, that was the kind of thing that like they serve people in nursing homes or something. You know, people that can't taste stuff, they just give them the plain chips. And to me, that's what I always thought. It was like it's just the plain stuff without any taste. If I want to eat chips, I'm not going to eat those. So I never really paid any attention to them. So here I am trying to be romantic, you know, having a picnic, and here's these nursing home chips, you know, plain Lay's chips. And so just to be nice, you know, I eat one, you know. Well, it says right there on the bag, you can't just eat one. So I'm eating one. I'm like, next thing you know, the bag's gone. And I ate them. And I'm sitting there thinking, how did I like this? And so that was the beginning of a tragic journey in my life. And even to this day, I can't have them around because I've realized I'm a chip junkie, I guess. And if I get into a bag of chips, even the plain ones, you know, just the now they're not the they have some that don't even have salt on them, I guess. And that I don't even know why they sell those, but they do have some that are good. But you know, I'm talking about just the plain Lay's potato chips. And I eat those, and it's all over. And you know the feeling. We all have those things. It's sort of, I don't know if you call it the kryptonite or whatever in your life. Where like there's a thing where you just have a certain. I mentioned having a hankering for things on Wednesday night. You know, a hankering for this or that. And so sometimes you get that. And there's that thing that just kind of pulls you in. Sometimes our flesh has a desire, these natural desires for things that can be a lot more deadly than a bag of chips. It can be a lot more tragic. And there's consequences that come with those things. We all have a sin nature. We understand that. And we all have certain desires that if we let those go, we're learning in the book of Proverbs that roads go where roads go. And if we go down those roads, it will end up in a very bad place. And what we see here in the life of Jacob's family in several ways, this is a very interesting chapter because each person here expresses that they indulge their flesh, they get carnal, and they do it in different ways, very different ways, but it's the same root problem, and it's just exploited in different ways. So let's look at this a little bit. We're going to start with Dinah and work our way through kind of examining the characters of the story. So Dinah here has a very foolish social life. That's kind of her kryptonite, if we want to call it that, okay? So she begins by just carnally mingling with pagans. That's what we're going to call it. Just carnal. That word carnal, I'm going to use that word this morning, and it just means natural. It's not wicked, it's just natural. It's just what comes. It's just kind of a natural desire. And she's got a natural desire to have friends. I mean, that's normal. I mean, that's very normal. Especially with Dinah, when you think about it, poor girl, she grew up in a home of 11 brothers. Now, you may have grown up as the only girl or the only boy. She's got 11 brothers, and it's just her. And this is in a day where she's really outnumbered, and that's, I don't know what her life was like there, but it says in verse 1 that she went out to see the daughters of the land. You can just kind of picture it. She needed some girl time. I mean, she needed that. The ladies are going out to the ladies' retreat here in Clovis here in a couple of weeks, and it's kind of some girl time there, just some time away. My wife is really looking forward to that, just to be able to leave the house and not have kids around or her weird husband or anything like that, just to be there with the ladies. And that's what Dinah's doing. She's just going out. She needs some girl time. And we don't know exactly what was going on, probably some kind of a festival, some kind of thing that's going on there the city of Shechem, got to get the name there right, Shalem, I'm sorry, the city of Shalem. And so she's going there. She is literally all alone in the middle of nowhere with nobody around, no other girls around. She's going over there to visit and to meet some people and to have some fun for once in her life. Nothing wicked or forbidden about that. She's just going there into the city. But that carnal mingling with pagans, that leads to the next step. It's always just one step at a time, and it leads into a carnal relationship. That carnal relationship that takes its steps along the way and ends up into a perversion of her morals. That's what takes place. She comes in here. I don't know exactly how the day unfolded, but she shows up. Here she's got a couple of her friends. They enjoy the atmosphere. They enjoy the food or the music or the party or whatever's going on. And of course, that afternoon, she's noticed by some boys because teenage boys notice teenage girls. That's just what happens. That's normal. And that we like for teenage boys to notice teenage girls. In our culture today, we have to make sure they're noticing those ones, you know, and that's good. It's like, I have nothing against guys liking girls. I'd rather that than the alternative. And so that's what they do. And so they're enjoying that. And of course they notice Dinah because she's new. I mean, she's just kind of showed up. She showed up. Her father's Jacob, you know, the one with the wealth of cattle. And Jacob was a very wealthy man. And the city of Shalem wasn't very large, maybe 500 to 1,000 people. So the cities back then are smaller in size. And so Jacob's wealth is pretty significant. I mean, he's there outside the city, and remember, he inherited, or sort of God gave him, all of Laban's wealth, and it's been multiplying, and so that's how cattle work. I mean, it's growing in God's blessing, and so he's got this tribe. I mean, he literally has a tribe right outside of the city. And so here's the daughter of the rich tribesman Jacob that shows up. So everyone, oh, that's Dinah. Okay. Poor girl. She's with all those guys. Yeah. So she's having a good time there. And then the coolest thing for her is when Shechem notices her. Now, Shechem is the prince of the city. Now, he can have anyone he wants. He's the prince. Everybody wants to impress him. You know, he's probably the quarterback, and he's homecoming king and all this stuff, or homecoming prince. He's just the prince. He doesn't have to be homecoming. He's prince all the time, not just homecoming, all the time. And so he's there, and he's the most amazing guy in town. This is like a Cinderella story. That's what's taking place. You know, she shows up, and they hang out, and they have a great time, and they love each other because they're teenagers, and they know what love is. And they, you know, because that's what teenagers know all about, what actual love is. No, they don't. But that's what they think they do. You know, they love each other. And so the night draws out. It's been the perfect night. And against their better judgment, she goes with him to the palace, and their love swells into something more. And before the night is over, he says here that he took her, he lay with her, and he defiled her. Now, there are several words in the Hebrew language that can be used to describe a rape or something like that, and this is not one of them. This is more, it appears to be more of a consensual thing. It's not that he violently attacked her and raped her as much as it was a consensual thing, and that's important because it appears that she just kind of lets things go as they will unfold. Well, when you do that, and you're going especially towards carnality, we see what happens here. It does unfold into something more. And to his credit, this young man, and we're going to look at him later, but he tries to make things right. But the focus of here is not really what Dinah did, but what it led to. Because this is just what she did. This is just her. And maybe in her mind, she's thinking, you know what? I have a lot of security in my family. My family is a godly family, a godly heritage. We have the promises of Jehovah God. That's been emphasized all through the book of Genesis up to this point, that these are God's people, and God's going to do great things with this family, and He is going to do great things with this family. And maybe she's kind of thinking, you know what? I can do what I want because I've got security over here with my family. But even though you've got a godly heritage, you can't escape the consequences of carnality and wickedness. There will always be consequences for wickedness. And that's what we see with Dinah right here. Because when you become a friend of the world, even if you have a godly heritage, when you become a friend of the world, you become an enemy of God. That's what the writer James said in the book of James, the half-brother of Jesus. He's writing to Christians in the book of James. And the book of James is a very practical book. It tells us really how to live like Christians. And in James chapter 4 and verse 4, he says, "Know ye," he starts out by saying, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses." That's a really loving term to just start talking to someone about. But he says, Hey, you're messing around. Like, what am I messing around with? I'm not having affairs with people. He says, "Know ye not that friendship with the world is enmity with God?" He says, "Therefore, whoever will be the friend of the world is the enemy of God." He says, "Look, you're a child of God. You've been saved, but don't you realize that if you become a friend of the world, if you become associated with the things that are of the world, then you position yourself as an enemy of God? You can't be both. You can't say, oh, I'm a child of God, I just kind of also do worldly things as well. Now, keep in mind, I'm not talking about having friends that are in the world. We're not supposed to be monks and just live in the monastery and never have associates. Even Jesus, as we're going through the book of Mark on Sunday nights, he associated with normal, sinful people. He didn't sin with them. But he associated with them in order to bring them into the kingdom, and that's fine. But what this is talking about is where a person does what Dinah did and just says, you know what, I'm sick of this. I'm going to go just have a good time over here in this worldly stuff. I still have the same family. I still have my relationship with God, but I'm just going to kind of let it go for a little while. Just kind of do what I mean, I kind of need to cut loose a little bit. I kind of need to I just feel all you know, hemmed in here. I need to just kind of relax morally for just a little bit, just a little carnality for just a little bit. And James says, when you do that, you position yourself as the enemy of God. Even though you're a child of God, you're fighting him. You're opposing him. That's not a good place to be. And that's what happens to Dinah. You can't escape the consequences of wickedness. You may have a future as a child of God. God may have great plans for you, but once you oppose him, once you get into carnality, you can end up forfeiting all that God has for you. I'm not talking about losing your salvation. Once you've trusted Christ as your Savior, all things are passed away. I mean, old things are passed away. All things are become new. You're a new creature in Christ, and you can't change who you are. I mean, you are a child of God. But your relationship with God and God's use of you on this earth doing His work, that can be forfeited. That can be set aside as you become really worthless to God. God's not going to work through his enemy. And if you're positioning yourself as an enemy, then that's a problem. We see this happen constantly, even in good Christian families. Even as I'm trying to raise my kids in church, I'm very aware, hey, just because they're being raised right doesn't mean that they're immune from making carnal choices. And that's what happened to Dinah. Very tragic. And it leads, it's a lot bigger than her. Her choice here goes a lot further than just one night with the prince. Now, it's a lot more than that. It's a lot more. And there's a lot of threats that begin to unfold. Let's look at these threats. A major threat against the family of promise. It appears to be very simple. Basically, Shechem, this young man, the son, he wants a bride. He wants a wife. And he found her. He found Dinah. He kind of went about it backwards because it says in verse 3 and 4, kind of what he says is just very, very rapid fire. He saw her. I guess that's verse 2. He saw her. He took her. He lay with her and defiled her. Then he was attached to her. And then he loved her. And then he spake kindly to her. He started wooing her. It's sort of almost exactly backwards of how it's supposed to work. It's supposed to go the other way, you know. But he really did feel like he loved her as much as he knew love, and however long they were together, he felt like he did. And it even the text even said he was more honorable than the other people in the city. But he had a normal desire, but the way they were going about this was very tricky. And a man named John Walton explained this a little bit. He said in their day, and of course we got to put ourselves in their culture, parent arranged marriages is just the norm. If you wanted to get married, you waited until your parents met her parents. And then they kind of put you together. And that could be great, and I can imagine it could be awful. But it's hard for us to even understand that because we're not used to that. If my mom and dad said, Abe, we're going to find you a wife, we're going to go find her, they may do that. I don't know. Never know. We would all be like, oh, that's odd. That's weird. And it would be today if that happened. I don't know many people that would just say, oh, well, that sounds great. No, probably not. But in their day, that was the norm. So if you, as a young person, if you found somebody, well, the chances of you actually getting married, it's not going to happen. The only way that could happen is if you took matters into your own hands, because they did have some customs back then. For example, if a man was seduced by a woman, or if a woman was raped by a man, and they came together sexually, then according to their law, and even in the book of Leviticus, their only option was to get married. That was their option. They were not available to marry anyone else outside of that. That was the only way to make it right. That was their culture in their day. I'm not saying that's what needs to happen today, but that's what their law was. They said that's the only possible way to make it right. So you can see how a very twisted young teenager could think around these rules and think, oh, well, we love each other, so let's just make it necessary for us to get married. And so that could be what they did here. In that moment of passion, they said, you know what, there's no way that our dads are going to agree to this, so let's just make it happen. And then they'll have to. And so that's what they, I mean, I don't know if that was their intent, but that certainly was a common thing that at least historically took place. And that is, this is a lot more than just two kids that love each other trying to get around their mean old parents, okay? Because do you remember, Dinah knew this, do you remember the great lengths that Abraham went through to get a wife for Isaac? Remember, he sent his servant all the way up to the northeast to find a wife. And then whenever Jacob, the reason Jacob went up there was to get a wife that was like them. And this isn't a racial thing as much as it's a religious thing, to make sure that it's in their family that they're going to be thinking right, because they knew, look, we got to be very careful not to intermarry with these other people with other belief systems, because their belief systems could be totally opposed to us. And they were setting this up. God was putting this in place because when the children of Israel occupied Canaan, there was going to be a lot of options, a lot of other religions. And we see that, just read through the book of Kings and Chronicles, as you see ones, even Solomon, that married foreign wives, that it wasn't that they were a different race, it was that they were a different religion, and totally turned his heart away from God. God began with this rule for a very important reason. Dinah knew that. She knew that. This wasn't just, our mean old parents won't let us date each other. This is a direct threat to their whole family structure, and Dinah is clueless. So Shechem wants a wife, but as we dig through here, we find an even greater threat, because the city of Shalem wants to take over Israel. Did you notice what happened? Let's see, back in verse 20 and 23, whenever Hamor and Shechem come into the city of Shalem, they have to convince these men to go through with this scheme. Now, I don't know, as we read through that, I don't know if you thought through this or not, but I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, how are you going to convince all the men in this city to go through this procedure? Like, they got to be nuts. Like, there's absolutely no way you're going to just say, yeah, all we have to do is be circumcised. Like, what? Like, we're not going to go. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just carnally minded, but I'm reading this thinking, how are you going to convince this? And they do convince them. They convince, and they don't even mention that Shechem wants to marry Dinah. You notice that? As they go through and starting in verse 20, and they're trying to, or I guess, yeah, they meet, they say, hey, these men are peaceable, they're dwelling with us, there's plenty of land, and they'll dwell with us, we'll give our daughters to them, they'll give their daughters, or, you know, we'll intermarry and everything. And then as they get to verse 23, there's a little subtle hint there to their intention. He says, shall not their cattle and their substance, and every beast of theirs be ours. This is a good old-fashioned conspiracy if you're paying attention to it, because what they're saying is, listen, here's this rich tribe over here. Lots of cattle, lots of herds. They're very wealthy. There's not that many of them, but there's a lot of cattle, a lot of wealth that could support our whole city. All we have to do is intermarry with them a little bit, and before you know it, the tribe of Jacob will not be the tribe of Jacob. It will all be the city of Shalem, and we'll all be one. In fact, he and Jacob said, yeah, we'll be as one. We'll just be all one. And what they're thinking, the city's thinking, yeah, and your wealth will be ours. Now, they're thinking their wealth, but with their wealth will come their religion, will come their way of life, will come everything. If they continue with this, and these men are thinking financially, but I guarantee you that behind the scenes, there was a spiritual enemy at play here that was saying, yeah, all you got to do is just absorb, the city could just absorb the people of God. And if they absorb the people of God under the guise of a peaceful covenant, next thing you know, there will be no people of God anymore. A simple arrangement here could have completely eliminated the nation of Israel very quickly. Just a generation or two, and they're done. There's not that many of them. He only has a dozen people and some servants and stuff. And within a generation, God's people would be completely gone. And everything that Israel had as the people of God would be forfeit. This is a lot larger than just a peace treaty and let our kids play together. This is a big deal. There's a lot more going on here than what you can see. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I enjoy a good conspiracy theory every once in a while, and I think it can be a little crazy. And then with most things in life, there's a ditch on both sides of the road, aren't there? There are some people that no matter what comes on the news, they're saying, did you see that? It's the end of whatever, and it's the conspiracy and the Illuminati and everything else, and there's those people, okay? And then there's people on the other side, though, who say, it's just like they have their hands over their eyes, and they say, I'm just naive and innocent. I don't think there's anything going on behind any scenes. I think it's just what you see is what you get. And both are foolish, and we need to be kind of the middle of the road on most of these things. And there are conspiracy things along the way. But the Bible tells us very clearly that there are things that are going on, more things going on than what you can see. In the book of Ephesians, Paul's writing to the church there at Ephesus. The book of Ephesians is primarily about how to live a spiritual life. And when he gets to the end in chapter 6, he encourages them. He says, before he closes out the letter, he says, he tells them that we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Our battle is not primarily against the things that you can see. And we see that in our nation. We see things during an election year, political things are at a hype, you know, and we see those things and we get nervous about stuff, and we should at different times. We need to be involved as we can. But there's more going on than just what you see. He says, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against the powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. There are spiritual things that are taking place. There is a spiritual battle that's going on. And if we're going to function as Christians, we need to realize that Satan and the forces of evil are very present in this world. If Satan were active in this world, I'm saying this tongue in cheek, if he were active, then I would think that he would be involved in things that don't seem dangerous, wouldn't he? I mean, if I were Satan, I would. I wouldn't just show up to people's doorstep dressed like Satan and say, I want your children. I mean, you should shoot me and run me off your property. Well, you couldn't shoot me and run me off your property, but you should do one of those, right? And so that's what should happen. Satan's not going to show up like that, but he is going to work through things that we get used to. He's going to work through our entertainment industry in our nation. And I'm not trying to get on a soapbox and preach hobby horse things, but we would be silly to think that in a culture that is so entertainment driven, which it is, I mean, I'm not trying to be nasty, I'm trying to be middle of the road here, okay? In a culture that is clearly entertainment driven, to the point that a sports figure can sit during the national anthem and make huge headlines, but politicians who are the ones supposed to be saying things about our nation don't really, nobody cares about. We're caring about the celebrities. I'm not even talking about the guy right now. I'm just saying, if something in our entertainment industry can make waves like that, then we are clearly focused on entertainment right now. So Satan, I would think, would want to be involved in that and just trying to send messages and to help us to slowly change our thinking along the way. It would in current issues and things, Satan would be involved in that. If he's wanting to adjust that, it's going to come across in things, well, in things as simple and things as innocent sounding as a marriage agreement. Hey, let's just let these people get married. You know, are you going to stand in the way of two people that love each other? Can you see what was going on back then? Does that sound familiar? Has that happened in our culture recently where people are saying, hey, here's two people that love each other. Are you going to tell me that these people can't love each other and get married? You know, well, in their day, it was because they were of two totally different backgrounds and things, and it was something that God said. In our day to day, it's the same story, except maybe it's two men or two women, and they say, "Hey, are you going to stand in the way of love? Are you going to say things like that?" And very quickly, God's people are in the place of saying, "Well, I mean, I do love people. I don't want to be mean about stuff." And next thing you know, one thing leads to another, and I'm talking about stuff that's just happened within the last few years. This isn't like ages ago. This is just like within the last, I mean, since I came here a year ago, I touched on it a little bit whenever I first came, and now it's totally common. That's been only a year ago. And these things are happening just very quickly. I'm not trying to be a conspiracy person. I'm just saying that there's more going on than what you can see. And if we're not careful, if we don't use wisdom, then we can easily get led astray along the way. This is a threat to God's people. This is a major threat. So God's people are being threatened by this whole city, and there's a lot going on that I don't think Jacob and all these people understand. But quickly, let's look at another side of this. We see the brothers just take over. Now, while Dinah's indulging in carnality with her boyfriend over here, her brothers are engaging in their own string of carnal choices. And their zeal, they have a lot of zeal, and their zeal is triggered by wickedness. They have righteous indignation, if you want to call it that. And they have a reason to be upset, because there's this guy, he's taking advantage of their sister. Of course, they're here on one side, and he now wants to come and marry her. And they said there at the end, he's treating our sister like a harlot, like a prostitute. He's going to use her and then come and ask permission to marry her. It's like, no way. And they want to kill the guy, but they can't just kill the guy. But that zeal is triggered by wickedness. Now that's right. That was a totally wrong thing that Shechem did. This wasn't culturally okay in any culture of that time. They respected sexual purity to a degree. Even the pagans, they had certain bounds here, and even they knew that this was wrong. And so, and here Israel, here Jacob, in verse 5, the dad, he just kind of holds his peace about it. And so the brothers, just their zeal starts to fuel their vengeance. They have this emotional response to what's going on. And so while they're justified in being upset for their sister, they are not justified in what they do. They lie. They say, hey, if you participate in this custom, then yeah, it'll be great. They have no intention of doing that. It's a trap. And that unbridled vengeance that they're giving place to, that they're just justifying in their mind, that unbridled vengeance gives place to violence. And the two or three go in. Simeon and Levi, that they go in and just destroy all of these men. The men that went out, it said that the men that go out, that means the military aged. Fighting men are the ones that agreed to this. And so all of their defenses are down for a couple days while they recover from this. And so these two guys come in and just kill them all. And then after they kill them all, at least those two, if not all the rest of them, but we see in verse 27 that the sons of Jacob, assuming that's the rest of them, here's the city just laid open. The men are all dead. There's no defenses. So they just go in and loot everything, like pirates. They just go in and take everything that the city had, from the cattle to their treasure to their women to everything. They just loot the entire thing. And it's an amazing turn of events that here they're mad at Shechem for taking their sister, and then they go through, and by the end of the story, they're taking everything that they have along the way. They seize that opportunity, they plunder their possessions, and they ruin the testimony of their entire family. Another term for unbridled passion and unbridled emotion is just carnality. That's what they're doing. It's the same root problem, it's just expressed in a different way. But you know, the cause of all this, the root, the father of all this would really be the father of the family, Jacob. Because he's kind of behind the scenes in all this. But Jacob is really the cause of most of this. Because Jacob, as we read at the end of chapter 33, Jacob's carnality has influenced his family. And here's how. Because Jacob, if you remember, God told Jacob way back in chapter 32 or so, he said, Jacob, you need to go back to Bethel. Go back to the place where I appeared to you. Go back to where I gave you my promise. And Jacob's on his way back when he stops at Shalem. Jacob stopped there. He failed to finish his journey. He just stops. We don't know why. He just goes along. Now he sets up an altar, but he just kind of stops short of what God has told him to do. And if you remember, I can remember another man, I think it was the nephew of Abraham named Lot, who set up camp right outside of a city. I doubt that Shechem was as wicked as Sodom and Gomorrah, but we learned from Lot that your children can very easily be influenced by a wicked city. And that's exactly what happens here. Jacob knows better than this. He's going, he's stopping, and he's just kind of setting up shop instead of continuing on. And now his children are being influenced along the way. Why did he do that? The text doesn't give us clear instruction, but it does show us where his motivation lie, because he's kind of a wet noodle throughout this story. He just kind of sits back and doesn't do anything. He doesn't say anything. The only time he gets really upset is at the very end. You notice at the very end, when his sons have gone and spoiled this whole city, then in verse 30, he starts to chew them out. And his main motivation is his fear. He's saying, look, now we're a small family. Now all the other tribes are going to get together, and they're going to come after us, and they're going to make us to stink in the land, and they're going to take over us. Jacob is a very fearful person. We've even seen that even when he was approaching Esau. Remember that? He was very fearful. Esau's going to come and kill me. He's like, well, he may, but you don't have any grounds for that. But he's a very fearful person. And here he knows better than this. God has allowed him to escape from Laban. God has allowed him to escape from Esau, and now under another threat, he just collapses. He just goes boneless. And as he finds out his daughter's been taken advantage of in the city, instead of doing something, he just sits. He's like, oh, I'll just wait, and just maybe it'll go away. And while he waits and maybe it'll go away, his sons come and just create carnage. And it goes on and on and on. What Jacob is realizing here, or what we see in Jacob, is that if he just stays in this comfy place, instead of pressing forward, instead of obeying God, and just kind of let the boys deal with this, maybe it'll all pass over. When he refuses to deal with his fears, he's not following God. He can't be following God if he's still sitting where he is right now. And selectively choosing God's way is not commitment. And that's what he's learning. God has given him instruction, and he'll follow it to a point, but then when it gets a little bit tough, he's like, I'll just kind of stop. Selectively choosing God's way is not commitment. And that attitude, that subtle attitude, that doesn't seem like a big deal, that subtle attitude has trickled down into each of his children. Because while Dinah knew that they were separated people and that her dad went all the way to Haran to get a wife, she knew that. But when the time came where she could get something that she could see, her carnality kicked in. And so she selectively chose to follow God, in this case, to not. And even with a godly heritage, she learned you can't escape the consequences of wickedness, and she reaped the consequences of that. The brothers, exactly the same thing. They knew, they have watched trickery in action. They've heard it from their father, they've watched it with Laban, they've seen their uncle Uncle Laban go through and try to manipulate Jacob, and they've seen God step in and stop that from happening. But instead of following that wisdom, they said, you know what? In this case, we have righteous reason. We are justified in taking out our wrath on this city. And instead of using wisdom, they followed their own schemes. They followed their own carnality. And those carnal reactions will lead to violence along the way. The major sin of Shechem at the end of the chapter, as they're justifying themselves, they say, look, he dealt with our sister as with a harlot. Meaning, instead of going through proper channels and doing things the right way, Shechem was wrong because he used her and then tried to settle up later. Isn't that sort of what God's people are doing here too? They're acting on their own desires. They're acting on their own passions. Yeah, they've got their position as the people of God, but they're acting on their own fears, their own passions, their own desires, assuming they can settle up later with God, assuming they can just kind of work it out a little bit later. Shechem was guilty of treating this girl as a prostitute, but the family was treating God the same way. And that really is the core problem that this family is facing right now. They don't have any control over their desires, over the munchies that they may have, over the things that they're craving. And when you don't bridle that, when you don't harness that, it will lead to wickedness, and you cannot escape the consequences of wickedness. James, I mentioned him earlier, as James is writing to these Christians in James chapter 1, he gives us the formula. He gives us the secret to all of this. He says, every man is tempted. That's normal. Every man, every woman is going to be tempted. And he says they're tempted when they're drawn away of their own lusts and enticed. There's their own thing that may attract them, their own thing that kind of scratches their itch or whatever it may be. And for everyone, it's different. Everyone may have a different thing. It may be, I mean, in this story, we have three. We have social activity. We have sexual activity. Well, we actually have four because Shechem had sexual desires, and Dinah, it was a social thing. The boys, it was more of just an anger issue. And with Jacob, it was fear. And no matter what it is, here's a family and another that have four totally different things. But on the bottom line, it's they're being drawn away of their own lusts, of their own desires, and enticed. And he says, when lust hath conceived, just like a child, just like it's growing in a womb, it's like when lust is conceived, just a little thing, he says, it brings forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, when it develops to full term, when that sin in your life develops, and we see what it grows into, sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. And then he says, do not err, my beloved brethren. He says, you know how this works. I'm telling you how this works. That's what James is saying. And then he's saying, don't be drawn off. Don't be drawn aside by an appetite. No one in this story planned on fornication or murder or piracy. I mean, none of them planned on that happening or the family becoming a curse in the land. But it happened when they went after carnal friendships. That's not a big deal, but it led to those things. When they gave up their righteous temperament. I just lost my temper a little bit. Yeah, you never thought it would lead to piracy, did you? But it did. And you were justified in being upset. But we got to be careful not to let that go or to indulge our worries and our fears. But you know what? God provides hope even in the middle of carnal choices. And this is where the sovereignty of God really comes out in this story, because it is amazing as you realize that Genesis is God's story. It's His story as we go through history, because in this story, God is still at work. Even though God's people made wrong choices, God somehow in His sovereignty uses that to bring about good. He does bring judgment on a wicked city. Now, they're not justified in what they did, but God uses that to bring justice to a wicked city. Dinah and Simeon and Levi will be punished. They will face consequences for that. Jacob is shown another object lesson. The nation of Israel sees, as they're reading this, they see the danger of connecting with wicked nations. Because when the nation of Israel later comes into the promised land under Joshua, they're going to be told, listen, when you get into the promised land, you're going to need to clean up the land. That means wiping out some cities. That means taking care of some business. We don't like to read about that. That makes us feel like, wait a minute, that's pretty violent. But we see why. We see why it was a very important thing for them to not be influenced by those wicked, by those godless people. And so even though it was wicked, God was able to work in spite of all that. But the lesson for us is that there is no escaping the consequences of carnality. Carnality leads to wickedness, and wickedness will always lead to sin, and the consequences of that are always great. We cannot escape that. It may just seem carnal. It may not seem like a big deal, but in the end, that there is always an effect for that. I want to close with, turn to the book of James, and I want to close with kind of our instructions here in the book of James in chapter 4. And let's stand together as we close here. That way you know I'm actually closing, okay? The book of James chapter 4, because he tells us what to do. Book of James chapter 4. And, of course, in verse 4 is where he said, look, don't you realize that friendship with the world is enmity with God? But then in verse 6, he gives us the hope. And we're going to see this next week as Jacob finally makes his way back to Bethel. But it says in verse 6, but he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. So if we're in a point where we're opposed to God, or we've been making carnal choices, then what are we supposed to do? Verse 7, he goes through a list. He says, submit yourselves therefore to God. Just humble yourself and submit yourself to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God. Get close to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts. You double-minded, trying to do two things at once. Purify your hearts. Pick a side. Be afflicted and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. There's hope, even if we've made carnal choices. Even if we're over our head in carnal choices, there's still hope. And it's not over. As long as you're still sucking air, there's still hope. There's still an opportunity for you to get things right with God, but it's going to mean saying no to self and saying yes to God. You'll never escape the consequences of wickedness. And carnal choices lead to wickedness. So be aware of the path. Don't be foolish. And I love how this ties right in with our Wednesday night series going through Proverbs about just showing. It's like, look, this is where bad choices lead. You don't have to be ignorant of that. You know where they lead. You know where bad choices lead. So if you know that carnal choices lead to wickedness and you can't escape the consequences of wickedness, then, well, don't eat just one. Don't even start in on carnality. Well, it's not wicked. No, but if it'll lead to it, then don't even start there. Don't even eat just one, even if it is a boring old nursing home chip. You know, even if it is one, if it's carnal, be very aware of that and know where those decisions can go. If you're messing with carnality, and that's just where we're at this morning, it may seem innocent, but don't be foolish about it. Be wise. Don't wind up like Dinah. Weird chapter in the Bible, but it's true. And it's there for a very important reason. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, I thank you for this opportunity that we have tonight. And Lord, as we go into this time of invitation this morning, I just want to thank you for your word. Lord, for giving us very clear instructions for how to live our life. Lord, none of us in this room have an excuse to make sinful choices, to indulge in carnality, thinking maybe it won't lead to wickedness this time. Lord, help us to be wise about that. Help us not to end up making foolish choices and opposing ourselves to you and facing the consequences of wickedness. Lord, just help us to learn a lesson from this very tragic story of this family. And I thank you, God, that in your sovereignty, you still reach out and cause us to get caught at times. You cause us to be convicted at times. And you sometimes will step in and keep us from ruining something completely. I thank you for your grace and your mercy. And Lord, this morning, I pray that if there's one here this morning that maybe has been indulging in an area that is absolutely uncalled for, Lord, in our hearts, we know that. I pray that you would help us to be willing to turn that over to you, and to be willing to take that step to humble ourselves and to get things right and to make steps forward from here in godliness and to get back on track. Lord, I thank you for your grace and for your mercy, even in this message, giving us hope and giving us the truth that we can hang on to, Father. Have your will and way in this invitation in Jesus' name. Amen.